This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iraq's Prime Minister unheard after a drone attack targets his residence in what his office says was an attempt to assassinate the official. Iran says Washington's claim of seeking negotiations and an agreement with Tehran runs counter to its so-called maximum pressure campaign. And Israel opposing the reopening of the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds. Welcome to the program. Our top story: Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi says he's unheard after a drone attack targeted his residence in Baghdad's Green Zone.
Thank God, me and those who work with me are in good health. Your heroic security and military forces are working on maintaining Iraq's stability and protection. The cowardly missiles and the cowardly drones do not build our nation and do not build our future. We are working on building our nation, on respecting the state and its establishments, securing better future for all Iraqis.
Kadhimi is calling on Iraqi citizens to remain calm and maintain peaceful dialogue for the sake of their country and its future. The attack has injured several members of Kadhimi's personal protection team. Iraq has seen some turmoil following last month's general elections. There have been protests over the election results. The latest protests in Baghdad just 2 days ago turned out of control and one person was killed. Following that, Kadhimi ordered a committee to investigate the violence. So far, there's been no claim of responsibility for the attack on the premier's house. But the Iraqi military says it was an attempt to assassinate the official. Remaining with that story about the failed attempt on the life of Iraq's prime minister, reactions from different groups and officials are now coming in. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose party won a majority in October's controversial parliamentary election, says the attack was an act of terrorism. He says targeting a senior official is an open attack on Iraq and its people. Sadr is calling on the military to take control until things return to normal. Also, a reaction from an official in neighboring Iran. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says the attack can be traced back to foreign think tanks that have been creating and supporting terrorist groups in Iraq, as well as to foreign invading powers that have brought insecurity and division to the country. Iran says the U.S. cannot carry on with its failed maximum pressure campaign on economic terrorism against the country while claiming to seek negotiations and an agreement at the same time. In a phone call with his Chinese counterpart, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian expressed hope that the U.S. and Europeans would take a realistic approach to the upcoming talks in Vienna so a deal can be achieved swiftly. Wang Yi said the U.S. is chiefly to blame for the embattled status of the 2015 nuclear deal. He expressed hope that the U.S. would make amends by removing all anti-Iran sanctions. The top Iranian diplomat also had a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart. Amir Abdullahian said Iran would return to full compliance with the agreement if the U.S. fully implements its obligations and refrains from making demands outside the scope of the deal. Amir Abdullahian, however, pointed to the recent U.S. sanctions against Iran's drone program, saying Tehran is skeptical about Washington's motives. Sergei Lavrov then said that all sides should resume implementing the deal, with the U.S. having to do so first. Political commentator Mr. Tony Gosling says Washington must re-enter the Iran nuclear deal by removing sanctions against the country.
The United States always seems to be trying to squeeze more out of this apple, more juice than is actually in there. What they do, they do this many, many times. And I remember a couple of years ago, the Russian President Vladimir Putin saying that the United States is not deal ready. It's basically saying that if you're sitting down to try and negotiate, in a way, you're wasting your time. Now, I think, you know, this is what we have to do. You've got to always try and negotiate. But it was really a great breakthrough for the world when the JCPOA was signed by President Obama back in 2015 with Iran. And this, what it did is it blocked out the Israelis. The Zionists really want to actually start conflict in the Middle East in order to drag the Americans in into the Middle East. So what needs to happen is the United States must go back, re-sign the deal with all of the other participants. As the sanctions begin to be lifted around the world against Iran, so that seems to be obvious. A child can see that that is what needs to happen if the US is serious about this deal. As Biden promised last year before he was elected, that he would re-sign this deal and he would put it back together.
Well, just hours ago, the Iranian army launched massive military exercises in a vast expanse of land and sea. Four units of the army, namely the Ground Force, the Naval Force, the Air Force, and the Air Defense Force, are taking part in the drills. The maneuvers cover an area of more than 1 million square kilometers, extending from the east of the Hormuz Strait all the way to the north of the Indian Ocean. The maneuvers are featuring a whole variety of exercises, including electronic warfare and reconnaissance drones. The drills also include the use of air defense batteries to strike mock enemy targets, plus air patrols by manned and unmanned aircraft. Our correspondent Youssef Jalali, who is at the site of the drills, had a conversation with the Army spokesperson for the maneuvers. Rear Admiral Mahmoud Mousavi told us more about the domestically developed military hardware and equipment that are being used during the drills.
These three-day drills will feature common operations by the four units in the air and on the ground and at sea. The equipment of the army developed domestically by local forces will be unveiled. This equipment has been developed and made by local forces, and this equipment will be showcased. Part of that equipment includes the aircraft equipped with air-to-surface missiles and precision-guided missiles, as well as a smart, cannon used in the armored division of the Army. Also, missile systems, which can counter air threats, also equipment used for by both manned and unmanned aircraft, combat aircraft, which can operate in different ranges, and they can conduct different reconnaissance and combat operations. These unmanned aircraft are all developed inside the country, and all the equipment installed on them has been developed inside the country as well.
Israel's prime minister says the regime would oppose the reopening of the U.S. consulate for Palestinians in Al-Quds.
There's so much more we agree upon with our American friends than we disagree upon, but indeed, our position is, and it was presented very clearly and openly to our American friends, that there's no room for another American consulate in Jerusalem.
Naftali Bennett suggested that such a mission should be opened elsewhere in the occupied West Bank. The consulate was shot and merged with the U.S. Embassy under former President Donald Trump in 2018. The Trump administration also recognized Al-Quds as Israel's capital and relocated the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to the illegally annexed city. The move sparked outrage among Palestinians who deem Al-Quds the capital of their future Palestinian state. Palestinians have laid to rest the body of a teenager killed by Israel or Israeli fire during clashes in the West Bank city of Nablus on Friday. Mohammed Da'adiz succumbed to injuries he sustained after he was shot in the abdomen in the village of Beit Dajan. Many others were also injured in the clashes that after protesters threw rocks at Israeli forces in the area to voice anger at the regime's settlement construction. The troops responded with live fire. Palestinian towns have been the scene of protests for months now over the regime's settlement activities and planned eviction of families from their ancestral homes. Dozens of people have been killed and many more wounded in the Israeli crackdown on protests this year. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest rally in front of the Red Cross office in solidarity with Palestinian inmates who are on a hunger strike for more than 100 days. Ruba Shabit is in Gaza.
The Prisoners Committee in the Gaza Strip held a rally in front of the Red Cross headquarters for the fourth consecutive day, protesting the Israeli illegal administrative detention policy practiced against Palestinian prisoners. This is part of a series of events held in the Gaza Strip in support of the prisoners whose health condition is deteriorating day by day due to their open-ended hunger strike.
We are here to send this clear message to our brothers and sisters in Israeli jails that we are proud of them for their resistance. There must be an end to their suffering. They have endangered their lives for the Palestinian cause, and now it is our duty to stand by them.
The protest comes as an Israeli court has reactivated its administrative detention order against Palestinian prisoner Miqdad Al-Qawasmi, who has been on a hunger strike for over 100 days.
We hold Israel accountable for the lives of our inmates. The resistance front is closely monitoring the situation. Israel will pay a heavy price for its brutal behavior. The international community must be committed to its duties before it's too late.
In October, Qawasmi was admitted to the intensive care unit in Kaplan Medical Center following a deterioration in his health condition. The Israeli regime transferred him to a prison clinic, submitting false reports about his health conditions. At present, around 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are reportedly held in Israeli jails, including 200 children and 36 women. Of that number, 500 prisoners are in administrative detention. The policy of administrative detention allows Israeli authorities to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial. Al-Qawasmi's health has been deteriorating as he is on the edge of death. However, the Israeli court has renewed his administrative detention with no charge. Six more Palestinian inmates are on hunger strike inside Israeli jails, suffering a critical health condition amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Well, let's take you back to an earlier story. In fact, our headline of the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi's house being targeted by drones that he has escaped unhurt from. On that story, of course, we gave you his own reaction as well as the international reactions from within Iraq by Muqtada al-Sadr and as well as an official from Iran. Let's get some idea into what that story is really about and who really benefits from that attempt on the life of the Iraqi premier through the help of Mr. Navid Behrouz, a political analyst who joins us via satellite out of the Iraqi capital of Baghdad. Mr. Behrouz, who do you think really benefits from this?
The latest news about the last night's event, I mean the assassination attempt on Mustafa Qasami, the Interior Ministry has released a statement saying that three drones at 3 a.m. They were flying over the house of Mustafa Qasami, and security forces, Iraqi security forces, managed to intercept 12 of the drones, but the third drone dropped its bombs on the house of Mr. Qasami, and the bombs exploded due to the attack. The Prime Minister escaped unhurt from the attack, of course, but those guarding the Prime Minister were wounded. As to who is behind the attack and who is to blame for, definitely many questions have been raised. One of the questions is that we know that inside the U.S. embassy in the green zone, maybe the distance between the U.S. embassy and the Mr. Qasami's house is less than a kilometer. There is an anti-missile defense system installed in this embassy, and this system can automatically intercept any projectile being fired at the green zone or at Baghdad or at the Prime Minister's house. If this system can automatically intercept actually any projectile being fired at that area, and in most of the cases this automatic system has been able to strike a target. The question is, why wasn't this system working at the time when three drones were flying over Mr. Al-Khadami's house, and the distance between his house and the U.S. embassy is less than a kilometer? This is a question which naturally should be answered by the United States and the U.S. Embassy. This is an accusation in the first place. Second, in terms of the timing of the attack happened at the time when a couple of days ago we had protests in Baghdad. A number of people were killed and hundreds of people were wounded in the protests. The protesters are demanding actually a change in the result of the election results, and also there were calls for the establishment of a fact-finding committee to launch a probe into those protests and violence and all that. And under such circumstances, we are seeing that an attack has been launched on the Prime Minister's house.
Mr. Navid Behrouz in Baghdad, many, many thanks.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight. Since the end of the Cold War, the number of nuclear weapons in the world has dropped dramatically to 15,000 warheads, according to the latest estimates. But given the fact that the explosive power of new nuclear weapons is thousands of times greater than that of the old nuclear weapons, the danger of the existing weapons to human life and the planet is no less, if not greater, than that of the old weapons in question. We now present you an article written by Majid Takht-e Ravanchi, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations. The piece is titled, "Iran Proposed Nuclear Disarmament Resolution is a Test for Positions and Claims of UN Member States." Under the Treaty of Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, all countries in the possession of such weapons have pledged to destroy all of their nuclear weapons. In addition, They're legally obliged not only to refrain from taking any action to manufacture nuclear weapons, but to refrain from transferring such weapons to other countries, deploying them outside of their territory, and cooperating with other governments to build atomic weapons. Under the pressure and pursuit of non-nuclear states, nuclear governments, after decades of non-compliance with their legal obligations, have once again been obliged to take practical and effective steps within the framework of the final documents of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, review conferences in 1995, 2000, and 2010. However, a look at the existing statistics and realities shows that not only nuclear states lack the necessary political incentive to achieve nuclear disarmament, but also their nuclear activities, including increasing the quality of nuclear weapons, modernizing and increasing the destructive power of these weapons, increasing the nuclear weapons budget, and promoting the status of nuclear weapons in national security doctrines, even in violation of international regulations and commitments, have created a situation in which the past trend does not show a significant move towards nuclear disarmament, and it does not seem that there would also be such a prospect in the future. It is worth emphasizing that in the absence of real nuclear disarmament, nuclear countries and their allied countries pursue a policy of reducing nuclear risk, which, given its very small scope and lack of consideration of real nuclear disarmament, it is not by any means possible to consider this ostensible policy as an alternative or equivalent to nuclear disarmament. In protest at this situation, since 2005, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been the main sponsor of the biennial resolution titled Pursuing the Implementation of the Agreements Reached at the NPT Member States' Five-Year Review Conferences since 1995. The main purpose of this resolution is the implementation of the commitments of the nuclear states on nuclear disarmament within the framework of the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT. The draft of this resolution was first submitted to the United Nations General Assembly's First Committee, the Committee on Disarmament and International Security, and after review and initial decision in this committee, the result will be sent to the General Assembly for a final decision. In the remainder of this program, we look at the structure and content of this resolution, possible interpretations of various countries' positions, and examine the principled point of view that a vote given to every resolution and proposal in the multilateral diplomacy is a test for the adjustment of the claims with the practical and declarative positions of the countries. And based on this, the countries' positions and claims can be verified in their various aspects. This resolution includes 9 introductory clauses and 6 executive ones. The introductory part, with reference to their previous biennial resolutions, the text of the NPT, the previous approval of the UN General Assembly to achieve nuclear disarmament, reminding and reaffirming the previously agreed upon obligations in review conferences after the indefinite renewal of the treaty in 1995 and beyond, expresses concern about the failure of the last review conference held in 2015. One of the most important clauses in this section is Introductory Clause 6, which emphasizes the implementation of the 1995 resolution of the NPT Review Conference on the establishment of a nuclear weapons-free West Asia region. The 1995 resolution on West Asia region calls on the Israeli regime to join the NPT and place its nuclear facilities under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. What adds to the significance of the 1995 resolution is the commitment of the three sponsors of the resolution, that is, the United States, Britain and Russia, to compel the Israeli regime to join in for the establishment of a nuclear weapon-free zone in the West Asia region. In the executive part of this resolution, it first states in paragraph 1 that the practical steps previously agreed to achieve disarmament in 2000 are still valid. And in paragraph 2, it states that it pursues the practical steps in implementing Article 6 of the Treaty on Nuclear Disarmament and the decision at the 1995 conference on the purposes and principles of nuclear disarmament. Executive Clause 3 calls on nuclear weapon states to expedite the implementation of their commitments to completely destroy their nuclear arsenals in accordance with the principles of transparency, irreversibility, and international oversight, and to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in their security doctrines. These countries have also been urged to initiate the practical process of achieving nuclear disarmament. Executive Clause 4 stresses the need for nuclear states to provide security assurances to non-nuclear states that they will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against them. Finally, in this section, all members of the United Nations are requested to pursue the implementation of the commitments accepted by the nuclear powers in the form of review conferences and the preliminary committees of these conferences. The Islamic Republic of Iran's proposed resolution was passed in the United Nations General Assembly First Committee this year with 108 votes in favor, 44 votes against, and 25 abstentions. Preliminary paragraph 6, which was also voted on separately, was approved by 109 votes in favor, 4 votes against, and 58 abstentions. According to regulations, the decisions by the UN General Assembly's committees, including the First Committee, are sent to the UN General Assembly in the form of the committee's recommendations, until about a month later, the General Assembly, as a higher body, makes a decision. Previous experience has shown that through the consultations of our country's delegation to attract a favorable opinion of those who voted against or abstained from voting, and also considering the participation of more members in the decision-making process of the UN General Assembly rather than those of the committees, Iran's proposed resolution will get more votes in the UN General Assembly. The results of the last vote of the UN General Assembly in 2019 shows that 118 countries voted in favor of Iran's resolution, 43 voted against, and there were 19 abstentions. As it is clear, the UN member states' reaction to Iran's proposal can be categorized into three groups. The majority of UN member states, particularly the non-nuclear member countries, the countries of the non-aligned movement that have always welcomed the proposal, have always supported this resolution. It is noteworthy that some non-nuclear states generally do not participate in meetings or sometimes do not vote. A group of countries have abstained from voting. They are non-nuclear, and although they have political reservations in supporting Iran's proposal, they are not against it as such, and they have decided to abstain. A negative vote to the introductory clause or to the whole resolution, especially by some countries, is questionable. In general, nuclear states oppose any explicit and objective proposal for nuclear disarmament, regardless of the country which makes the proposal. The so-called nuclear umbrella countries, which possess security guarantees given to them by the nuclear states, also try to give a negative vote to such proposals to show their political support for the nuclear states, whilst taking the stance of nuclear countries into consideration and with an intention of taking no position that leads to the cessation of umbrella support. In general, the United States, the Israeli regime, and Western countries have always been among the opponents of Iran's proposal. The United States and Israel have always called for a vote on preliminary paragraph 6 and the entire resolution. As mentioned, any declared stance and practical action of countries in international forums can be clear evidence for the verification of claims. In the specific context of this resolution, the point of departure, content, request, and direction of the resolution clearly indicate the need for objective fulfillment of disarmament obligations. And in the meantime, the Islamic Republic of Iran, like other non-nuclear countries, has no interest but to strengthen international peace and security through the elimination of all existing threats, including the threat of nuclear weapons. On the other hand, the hypocrisy in the positions of Western countries, which always turn a blind eye to the arsenal of weapons of mass destruction of the Israeli regime and point the finger of blame at the Islamic Republic of Iran, has become clear with a negative vote on the resolution proposed by Iran. Because in practice, these countries, while expressing concern about the danger of nuclear proliferation, oppose the genuine demand for nuclear disarmament and the complete destruction of all nuclear weapons, and in today's transparent international community, no one buys such claims. At this year's meeting of the Committee on Disarmament and International Security, the Islamic Republic of Iran, as in previous years, referred to the new nuclear arms race and the process of modernization of these weapons at an alarming rate, and called for an end to such actions and said it will continue to do so with strong determination. Iran believes that the global security becomes more vulnerable, more fragile with nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction, and therefore creating a secure world requires the complete annihilation of all such weapons, and at the forefront of them, nuclear weapons. In line with this policy, Iran has proposed the creation of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the West Asia region.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
communique.
Resistance forces have attacked a U.S. military base in Syria. This is the first time the illegal military installation located in El Tanaf was directly hit in what has been described as a coordinated operation using sophisticated weaponry. It comes just a few days after Israeli warplanes flying from the direction of the American base bombed Syria, leaving one Syrian soldier dead and wounding three others. It also follows a terrorist attack in central Damascus, which killed 14 Syrian military personnel. So why is this attack on El Tanaf so significant? This American base had never been attacked up until this point, so why now? How come Israeli planes decided to fly in from the direction of El Tanaf instead of the occupied Golan Heights like they usually do? And why did Israel just bomb Damascus using a surface-to-surface missile instead of the usual airstrikes? Does this mean a shift in the balance of power, or are we seeing new rules of engagement being established on the ground? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Syria has been at war now for 10 years, or I should say, the world has been at war with Syria for 10 years. We've had the United States, United Kingdom, France, Israel, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others trying to overthrow the Syrian government through various means. As we now know, the biggest players in the war proved not to be so-called freedom fighters, as the media would have you believe, but foreign-backed terrorists, extremist takfiri groups, funded, armed, and trained by the United States and its regional allies. With the help of Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Hashd al-Shaabi, or popular mobilization forces, Syria was able to push back against Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and other terrorist groups. And while the tide of the war swung in its favor, and the Syrian government has largely taken back most of Syrian territory, the war has also taken on a new dimension. In June 2020, the Trump administration imposed the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria, designed to suffocate the Syrian people. These sanctions have caused hyperinflation and the value of the Syrian pound, the lira, to plunge significantly. At the same time, the United States is also occupying some of Syria's most precious resources, its crops and oil fields, mainly in the northeastern and eastern regions of Hasake and Deir ez-Zor. The goal of this is to starve the Syrian people in the hopes they rise up against the government in discontent. So in addition to sanctions, hyperinflation, and a devaluated currency, Syrians are deprived of accessing their own crops, oil, and gas. And while Syria is not a significant or major producer of oil and gas when compared to other countries, oil is still a precious resource which accounts for around 25% of government revenue, according to the IMF. As it illegally occupies Syria, the United States has a whole network of bases which just so happen to be right where Syria's oil and crops are. What a coincidence. The United States regularly steals this oil and smuggles it through the El Walid border crossing with Iraq, a country it has occupied since 2003. At the same time, the U.S. ferries supplies regularly from its Iraqi bases into Syria, with reports of U.S. convoys, trucks, and tankers driving in broad daylight. In addition to all this, there is one base that didn't get a lot of attention until now. It is the U.S. garrison at El Tanaf. Situated in the Homs governorate, the base lies just a few hundred kilometers from the Syrian capital, Damascus. The base is not just a threat by virtue of being a military base of a foreign occupying power, but also because of its strategic location. El Tanaf sits on the M2 highway between Damascus and Baghdad, and near Syria's borders with Iraq and Jordan. This is designed to deprive the Syrian government, and by extension the Syrian people, of logistical, economic, and military capabilities, while also controlling what flows into and out of Syria in regards to occupied Iraq and Jordan, an ally of the United States. To get a better idea of why this space is so important, I want to bring in Leif Ma'rouf. He's a Lebanese journalist, international affairs analyst, and media policy consultant. He's worked a long time in media, radio, television, and print, and has been an activist on Palestinian and Arab rights in the West. Leif, thanks for being with us. Before we get into the attack on El Tanaf, could you perhaps break down what the purpose of this illegal military base is, especially given its geographic location? You know, it's right on the border between Syria, Iraq, Syria, Jordan. Why did the Americans put it there? What implications does it have besides being a military installation?
Well, definitely, if you look at the map,
It's clear. They put it on the triangle between Iraq, Syria, and Jordan. There's a main highway that connects Baghdad to Damascus that passes through there. And that means that this is the main route of trade between not only Iraq and Syria, but also all the way to Iran. So the idea for the Americans to put this illegal occupation base in Al-Kanaf is to make it costly for Syria to have any economic and or military relationships with Iraq and Iran. So now, if you notice, the only open trade route for between Iraq and Syria is in Abu Kamal, in Deir ez-Zor, which is, you know, hundreds of kilometers north of that. So the, you know, the route of trade to Damascus, to Baghdad, has an added 8 hours of driving because of Al-Kanaf being where it is.
On the night of October 20th, the illegal U.S. military base at Al-Tanaf came under attack from suicide drones. Now, these drones are not the kind that land and refuel. They're one way, so to speak, and designed to explode on impact. Al-Tanaf was hit by 5 of these drones, according to sources of the Lebanese news channel El Mayadeen. The base was also hit by rocket fire, and the army barracks are reported to have been burned and destroyed. And as the photos show, the damage was quite significant and extensive. A military source from U.S. Central Command told Sky News Arabic that there were no casualties and that losses were only limited to material damages. Now, let's look at the timeline, because just a week earlier, on October 14th, Israeli warplanes illegally bombed Syria for the second time in the span of a week, killing 1 Syrian soldier and wounding 3 others. They struck an area just south of the ancient city of Palmyra, which is thousands of years old and located on the ancient Silk Road. Now, Israel bombs Syria virtually every week. But this time, instead of flying in from the direction of Lebanon and the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, Israeli warplanes reportedly flew in from the direction of the American base at Al-Tanaf, which lies to the east, for the second time in a row, because this is the same direction they came in from when they bombed Syria the week before. Now, Leith, this attack on the American base at Al-Tanaf, which is the first, if I'm not mistaken, it comes just a few days after Israel bombed Syria south of Palmyra, right? Twice within the span of a few days. Can you maybe expand on the significance of the attack on Al-Tanaf and the context in which it took place?
It's very significant because it can reveal to you the actual purpose of this attack. Because, you see, the Israeli attack that you just mentioned happened from Al-Tanaf. So the Zionist Air Force flew over Jordan into Iraq, stationed itself on top of Al-Tanaf, and fired its missiles on Palmyra, on the military base in the T4, and also the phosphate factory, by the way. They attacked civilian infrastructure in this situation. And they hid behind 2 civilian airlines, one of them going to Damascus, the other going to Beirut, to protect themselves from the Syrian air defenses. And this is the only reason, actually, they were successful. So they had the protection of both, one, the airspace that the United States is claiming for itself from the Tanaf Air Base, and two, the protection of 2 civilian airlines. You know, and so the Syrian military and the Syrian government sacrificed its own members of its forces in order to protect the civilians in those airlines. They could have fired at the Israeli Air Force that was over Al-Tanaf, but then there would have been the possibility of the civilian airplane. This was a message to the Americans, not only to the Israelis. The attack on Al-Tanaf by the Syrian Air Army and its allied forces, yeah, was a message to the Americans that this will not be allowed to happen again from their airspace.
But, you know, some people have drawn comparisons between this attack on Al-Tanaf and the one at Ayn al-Assad after General Soleimani was martyred. But if we talk about comparisons, perhaps we can go a bit further, right? Because it's like you said, the response afterwards from the Americans, well, where is it?
Nothing, saying that they're ready to, they will, have the response at the time that they choose. that reminds us of, you know, the feeble responses from Arab states long time ago, when they used to say, use this phrase, we'll respond in the correct time and place, and no response comes. So to hear it from the empire, it's a big change in reality that we are living today.
If there's to be a response, it'll be at a time and a place and a manner of our choosing, and we certainly won't get ahead of those kinds of decisions.
When we look at what happened at El Tanaf, there were no casualties. However, the barracks were completely destroyed and burned. I believe the warehouses were targeted as well. So there were not only 5 suicide drones used, but rockets as well. What does this mean in terms of the sophistication of the attack and the rules of engagement? Is the resistance getting stronger by this metric? How does this change the balance of powers on the ground?
I'm glad that you mentioned the barrage of missiles, because this is very important. It was a tactical choice to fire a barrage of missiles prior to the drones hitting the base. So that confused the defenses of the base, and there was chaos on the ground in the base, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, the suicide drones hit the base in the midst of this chaos. So what did it send as a message to the Americans is that all weapons are now possible to be used against the American presence in Syrian territory.
You mentioned the shifting of forces and the balance of power in the region. Just recently, we saw the United States flee Afghanistan, but El Tanaf was attacked, and you know the Americans still have a large military presence in Deir ez-Zor and Hasakeh, so eastern and northeastern Syria. They are occupying the oil and the crops there, the breadbasket region. Do you think they will leave that anytime soon? Will they leave El Tanaf anytime soon?
So, you know, first off, in terms of what's happening in the northeast and Hasakeh and Deir ez-Zor, prior to even the attack on El Tanaf, you know, a week before that or 2 weeks before that, there was an attack on the Conoco oil fields where the Americans have stationed their biggest base in the northeast. It was, again, drones and a volley of missiles. And again, that was a message to the Americans. So over the last week, almost every day, the Syrian military and civilians in Hasakeh and Deir ez-Zor cut the path of American convoys that were trying to go into different regions and push them back to their bases. So we know that on the ground in the northeast, it is not an easy job for the Americans to stay there. There's been multiple messages clearly that there is a local resistance that's building up. And if we couple that with the situation in Iraq, where the Americans had promised, maybe they're lying, but for now they promised that they will be withdrawing all their fighting force from Iraq by the end of the year, this will mean that it's the supply routes for the American troops in northeast Syria will end.
The Arab states and kingdoms you mentioned in the Persian Gulf recalling their diplomats from Lebanon, could you perhaps expand on how it connects to all this and how it could affect the resistance axis?
In terms of this schism within the imperial order that we see, this is festering. You know, people don't connect what happened in January 6th in Washington, D.C. to what's happening on Syria. But truthfully, Syria wasn't only successful in defeating the, you know, imperialist war, a decade of imperialist war on the ground in Syria, but the actual victory of Syria has caused what we see globally right now, what's happening even on the coasts of China, what's happening on the border of Russia, what's happening in terms of the success in Yemen, all of that is owed to the success of the Syrian people, their military, and their government to resist for a decade one of the most brutal, contra wars that we've seen in history.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time. and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Five days after the attack, we began seeing reports in the media blaming, you guessed it, Iran. The Associated Press put out an article titled, Officials, Iran Behind a Drone Attack on U.S. Base in Syria. Now, these anonymous U.S. officials say that, quote, they were Iranian drones, and Iran appears to have facilitated their use. Right, so Iran facilitated their use. That's a bit vague, isn't it? What does that even mean? Did Iran specifically transfer these drones for this use? Did Iran provide coordinates, intelligence, fuel, paint and stickers for the drones? I mean, this is so vague. The average person who's reading this has no idea what it means. They would just take this at face value. You know, these U.S. officials, who are conveniently speaking on the condition of anonymity, go on to say that Iran resourced and encouraged the attack, but that the drones were not launched from Iran. Now, fielding questions from reporters about the attack, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said, quote, I'm not in a position to get into attribution. I'm not going to talk specifics on the attack. Okay, so was it or was it not Iran? In direct contradiction with these anonymous U.S. officials, the Pentagon spokesperson, John Kirby, cannot even tell what munitions were used, let alone Iranian ones. He won't confirm if it's a Shia militia group, which again doesn't necessarily mean Iran, but he also does not confirm whether it's a state-sponsored attack.
Can we assume it was a Shia militia group, or is that not what
I said? We've seen these kinds of attacks before. I'm not going to get into specific attribution on this one.
The number of rockets, do we have any more specifics on that? We were told two drones and a number of rockets. Are there
I don't have an update for you on the on the munitions that were used. We believe it was a complex, coordinated, and deliberate attack.
And is it possible that this was a state-sponsored attack?
Again, I'm not going to go any further on attribution at this point. We're still working our way through.
So the Americans have said that they were warned in advance, they were tipped off about the attack, and they've also blamed Iran for it. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think they're just using this as a card to hold against Iran? Because if we're being realistic, you know, when you invade other countries, Syria in this case, you're going to anger a lot of people. So it could have been Syrians, Iraqis. I mean, why are they doing that? Why are they saying that? And is there some truth to it?
Well, just saying the word Iran is a buzzword that is used in the Western propaganda. And anybody and everybody that's resisting American hegemony and its vessels, the Saudis, the Israelis in the region here in Western Asia, is called an Iranian tool, and Iran is blamed for it. So unfortunately for the American public, this doesn't portray the truth, which is that there is an alliance of sovereign states and actors like Hezbollah, like the Syrian government, like the Yemeni resistance, that are choosing to align themselves together because they have a strategic goal of forcing the United States and its vessels out of the region. So the truth is, until now, we don't have a clear indication, a written statement, an announcement by who actually committed this resistance attack on Al-Tanf base. But it doesn't matter, really, because we know that the Syrian government itself said that it's going from this point on to be responding to any Israeli attacks. So that gives you an indication.
The same day that Al-Tanf was hit, 14 Syrian military personnel were killed in a terrorist attack in central Damascus. How does that tie in to the events at Al-Tanf?
So it's clear that there is some schism within the imperial, coalition. So we know this schism started way back with Obama and his plan to bring the Muslim Brotherhood into power in the Arabic world, led by Turkey and Qatar, and that led to a revolt by the Saudis and the Israelis, and who brought Trump into power. Okay, so that's a schism between the Wahhabi and the Ikhwani, or conservative and liberal sides of imperialism, if you want to say so. And we know that right now, Egypt and Jordan, in alliance with the liberal wings of the empire, were trying to bring in electricity and gas to Lebanon through Syria. And part of this, you know, Biden being part of the liberal side of the empire, had, you know, facilitated this. And so we saw the withdrawal of all the Wahhabi Contras from the south of Syria, and the, you know, expansion of the Syrian military presence all the way to the Golan Heights borders of the occupied part. And so this suicide, well, it wasn't a suicide, it's three different IUDs that were placed, two of them exploded, one of them didn't. Is it probably a message from the Saudis and the Israelis, the conservative part of the empire, that are rebelling against the possibility of opening relations between Jordan, Egypt, and Syria and Lebanon, and the lifting of the Lebanese economic crisis?
About a week after the attack on Al Tanf, Israel again bombed Syria, not by air like it usually does, but using surface-to-surface missiles. Laith, why do you think the Zionists took a different approach to Syria this time and did not use their